ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is Monday, September 22nd, 2008, and this was the day that Nathan Hale was hanged as a spy by the British, and they call themselves our allies. But this was 1776, so it's understandable things weren't quite the same. And it was on this date, September 22nd, that the U.S. Congress authorized the office of Postmaster General in 1789, made famous in a Seinfeld episode in which Kramer was taken before the Postmaster General, who's a general whose job was to, by God, get things done. And it's the birthday of Joan Jett. I'm moving up. I could have told you it was the birthday of Michael Faraday in the same era, 1791. Instead, Joan Jett from Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. I have to just tell a brief story. So I've seen Joan Jett and the Blackhearts in concert more than once, but my first experience was unique. She was the warm-up band for, I don't even remember who, and a big name band. And I walked into the arena in the middle of her set, and she's singing and strumming at the top of her lungs, playing guitar fast and loud, and she's singing, "No, I don't give a damn about my reputation." "No, I don't give a damn about my reputation." And I thought, okay, this is Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. And I actually went back and saw her later as a headliner because someone had told me, no, she's really good. You really should check her out. And I saw her in a smaller venue, sat about 3,000 people in a large theater in New York City. And I have to say, she was pretty dang good. But it's her birthday, and she was born in 1960, which makes her 10 years younger than me and makes her 48 this year. Hard to believe. Okay, so we got a bunch of things on the agenda, not to mention the hidden agenda, but let us start with the miscellaneous stuff. And in the world of miscellaneous, we're going to move into the financial meltdown pretty quickly, but it is worth mentioning that Richard Wright died last week, and I'd heard about it just about the time I came on the air last week, and I didn't have any Pink Floyd with me, but he was the keyboard player for Pink Floyd and a founding member. So on our breaks, we will play a little bit of Floyd from at least small cuts, and we'll leave it at that. He was 65 and he died of cancer. You know, used to be when my rock and roll heroes died, it was drug overdoses. Now it's old age and cancer. I think Pink Floyd coined a phrase about that. Anyway, Rick Wright wasn't necessarily one of my heroes, but an integral part of an interesting band. Next up, yesterday was the last game played in old Yankee Stadium. They will tear it down this winter. The new stadium's almost complete, and it is over. They had dozens and dozens of former Yankees there, retired players, six of whom are in the Hall of Fame, just to give you an idea. And most of their Hall of Famers have passed away. You know, some of the most interesting moments in the history of sports took place in Yankee Stadium, and they aren't even the shot heard around the world and Reggie Jackson's three home runs that made him Mr. October in the 77 World Series and all that stuff. And it's not even Don Larsen's perfect game, the only perfect game pitched in World Series history. It's things like Lou Gehrig's farewell, when he said, "I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth," as he was facing certain death from ALS. Just an amazing history in Yankee Stadium. And so I made one last pilgrimage to Yankee Stadium this summer. I used to live in the New York area, and so I've been there any number of times. But made one last pilgrimage. I was at a conference back in August, and so I grabbed a friend, and we went down to Yankee Stadium and scalped a pair of tickets to see a game. And sat close to the field for several innings. We were in the second row right off the fence. A-Rod was within 30 feet of me at one point. Anyway, I saw a game at the old Yankee Stadium for the last time this summer, and now it's over. They finished yesterday, and it is all over. Let's see. The other thing going on in the world of sports is that the U.S. team won the Ryder Cup yesterday. Europe has won several times in a row. I think they've won since 1999. And finally, the U.S. reclaimed the Ryder Cup. And interestingly, they did it without Tiger Woods, who's injured and out for the year. Now, nobody says much about that, actually, what the U.S. chances were going in or whatever, but they played really well. And yesterday, Jon Stewart won an Emmy for Outstanding Variety Music or Comedy Series. And Stephen Colbert won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing in a Variety Music or Comedy Program. Two of the best comedians on TV because they do social commentary, essentially. And Stephen Colbert on his Colbert Report has an interesting thing running where he's been complaining about Manilow for 2 years because Barry Manilow beat him out for the Emmy in 2006 for Outstanding Individual Performance in a Variety or Musical Program. And then Tony Bennett won it last year. So he's got this running feud, supposedly, with these guys. And Don Rickles beat him this time. So Colbert, I'm sure, on tonight's show or tomorrow's show will be regaling us with the story of his Emmy, but also he may still complain that he didn't win the one he really wanted and that Rickles took it from him. But I guess it's worth making an observation I've made before about comedy. You know, when you listen to the right-wingers talk, they talk about Daily Show and Stephen Colbert. Like, oh, they dismiss them like, oh, they're just liberals. Actually, one of the interesting things, oh, and that people have been complaining that the late-night guys, including David Letterman and, The Tonight Show, Jay Leno, have been beating up on Sarah Palin, mocking Sarah Palin. So when I'm listening to somebody, it might have been Bill O'Reilly, somebody talk about the unfair treatment of Sarah Palin, and there they are showing clips from Jay Leno and David Letterman, and I'm thinking, these guys are comedians. What do you expect them to do? Don't you remember how they savaged Clinton? And that's the thing about a good comedian is there's no subject off limits. Jay Leno picks on who's ever president. He picks on who's ever in the news. If you're a caricature, you are ripe for jokes. Clinton will always be the butt of jokes about sex. Dick Cheney will always be the butt of jokes about shooting someone in the face. And Sarah Palin will be the butt of jokes about lipstick or about field dressing a moose or about hockey moms or whatever it is. That's just the way it works. Now, in The Daily Show and Colbert Report, admittedly, they are slanted left, but they are not exclusively left. And by that, I mean they poke fun at Obama, they poke fun at Hillary, they poke fun at the left. And that one of the interesting things is when you see right-wing comedy, and I don't mean everybody, there are conservative comedians on Comedy Central and things like that who will poke fun at both right and left. But I'm thinking of a couple of things. For example, Rush Limbaugh fancies himself a comedian of sorts, but he never makes fun of anything but the opposition. He doesn't seem to be able to have any fun with his own side. And it's the same for a cartoon strip like Mallard Fillmore. Now, if you get the Washington Post in this area, you don't get Mallard Fillmore, but you would get it if you picked up the Washington Times. And the counterpart to that, some people argue, is Doonesbury in the Washington Post and in hundreds of other papers. Here's the difference. Gary Trudeau may be left-leaning, but when Jimmy Carter's in office, he savages him. When Bill Clinton's in office, he savages him. Bill Clinton's icon in the strip was a waffle covered in syrup, to give you an idea of how brutal he was with his treatment of Clinton for waffling. But when you read Mallard Fillmore, and I've read a couple hundred of those strips, he has never once poked fun at the right. He only pokes fun at the opposition. So it's partisan humor, for whatever that's worth. Anyway, Daily Show and Colbert Report are primarily poking fun at the right, but they do take shots at their own side. And I like that about they're equal opportunity abusers, and I like that. Okay, so this is it's a somewhat serious note, and I'm not even going to get into it for that reason. So let's move on. Now, the financial meltdown has obscured any number of stories going on in the world, only a few of which I'm going to mention here. For example, Petraeus has stepped down, and General Ray Odierno has assumed command of the American forces at Iraq this week. You don't hear a peep about it. That would be big news if we weren't in the middle of a financial meltdown. There was a suicide blast in Pakistan, and it was huge. It took off the entire front face of the Marriott, and it left a 30-foot crater. It killed over 60 people. I mean, the front of that building isn't quite as bad. It doesn't look quite as bad as when Timothy McVeigh bombed the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City. He destroyed not just the facade, but entire portions of that building. This just blew out everything on the front side and blackened everything. But it blackened it six stories up and, well, it must be 30 rooms across. I mean, it's just unbelievable the damage it did. And is it making much news over here? No, it is not. Semi-big news. Not big news. It was a controversy. So Hillary Clinton had been invited to speak in New York City at this event that was being put together by a couple of Jewish groups to protest Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, who is here this week, and he's going to speak to the UN General Assembly tomorrow. And so there was a big protest today. Hillary was invited to speak. And then the organizers, I don't think they talked to her, said, hey, I got an idea. Let's get Sarah Palin here. So they invited Sarah Palin to speak. She accepted, and Hillary pulled out. And Hillary said, I didn't expect this to be a partisan thing. She didn't want it to be about the election in comparison of her to Palin. It was a chance to protest Ahmadinejad. And she's the senator from New York. So she pulled out. And then when the organizers realized what happened, they rescinded the invitation to Palin. And all I heard from the right wing about this, and you folks know, I tune in so you don't have to. I hear several radio talk shows a day, not the whole thing. I hear 10, 15 minutes of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and a few other people every day. I was listening to Austin Hill on the way in. And there are several of them who are, anybody who's tackling this is complaining that the Democratic Party and Hillary went back to the organizers and got Palin disinvited. You know, I kind of bet that didn't happen. They all expected she would be reinvited. As far as I know, and I haven't been following the story that close, she didn't go back. She wasn't reinvited, I don't think. And I could be wrong about this, okay? But the idea was it was supposed to be non-political. And so Palin was disinvited, and the right sees a conspiracy there, okay? I just think Hillary, well, frankly, if Hillary's anything, she's a little shy. That is, she's not interested in helping Obama take on Palin. She's not willing to go out there and say, I too have a vagina, and I do not support Sarah Palin. Now, she does say, no way, no McCain, no Palin. But she doesn't want to be seen as taking on Palin directly. A, it's not her job, is her feeling, I think, although, frankly, the Democrats could use her as a surrogate in that role if she'd be willing to play it. But secondly, I'm guessing it's a crass political move. That is, to the extent that there are crossover women who are going to vote for Palin McCain, she doesn't want to lose those women in any future election. She wants them to see her as reasonable and moderate, and she doesn't want them to take offense. So my guess is she's really protecting her political viability for the future more than anything. Anyway, that little flap is over. And then Dick Cheney is in the news. So first of all, Dick Cheney was told to keep official records. People filed suit because they were afraid, with Dick Cheney's claiming he's not part of the executive branch, he's not part of the legislative, and he's been unwilling to turn over the regular reports he's supposed to the archives, the National Archives, and that every other VP has been doing. I forget who it was that sued him. I think it was Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics. Sued Cheney, and a judge ruled in their favor and said, yes, you must keep your official records. You cannot delete them, shred them, whatever. You must turn them over when you're done. Because everyone suspected Cheney wouldn't do it. He doesn't believe in that sort of thing. And the last little piece about Cheney that was interesting and a juicy little tidbit that passed almost unnoticed last week with the financial meltdown we suffered was that no less a Republican and partisan than Dick Armey, and Dick Armey's a good guy. He's actually will tell you the truth more than almost any Republican or Democrat. Now, he's out of the House of Representatives, but he was a representative from Texas for many years. And he basically came out and said that Dick Cheney lied to him in the run-up to Iraq. And basically, Armey had spoken out against going to war with Iraq, right? And the fact that he was opposed also allowed some Democrats to come out and gave him cover because they feared that, you know, it will look weak, the Democratic Party will look weak if we oppose this war. But in fact, Armey then reversed his position after he sat down with Cheney. This comes out in a new book that Armey is quoted in. And he basically came out and said that Cheney told him in this private meeting that the threat from Iraq, this is back in 2002, was actually more imminent than we want to portray it to the public at large. So you'll have to trust me on this. But that Iraq's quote, and this is a quote from Dick Armey, their ability to miniaturize weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear, and have been, quote, substantially refined since the first Gulf War, and would soon result in, quote, packages that could be moved even by ground personnel. In other words, suitcase nukes, right? Basically claiming that the Hussein has ties to al-Qaeda, and we know, meaning the U.S. knows, that they have the ability to deliver those weapons in portable fashion. They have a delivery system, and they have this relationship with al-Qaeda. Of course, they didn't have a relationship with al-Qaeda either. And so Armey said basically that Dick Cheney told him things he knew to be untrue. He wouldn't come out and say he was a liar. But he did say, had I known or believed then what I believe now, I would have publicly opposed the war resolution right to the bitter end, and I believe I might have stopped it from happening. So there you are. In private, Dick Cheney is lying through his teeth. And with that, on that happy note, let us take a short break. This is the Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio in Fairfax, Virginia.
You're listening to The Andy Fin Show, centrally located in America, on the TAFS Radio Network.
We are back on The Andy Fin Show, and on this date, September 22nd, in 1975, someone attempted to assassinate Gerald Ford, and it was the second assassination attempt in 17 days. A really bizarre occurrence. I remember when these happened. Do you remember the names of either of the people who attempted to assassinate Gerald Ford? And by the way, they had something in common. Like Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton, they both had vaginas. So it was two women. Now, these weren't serious hits the way Lee Harvey Oswald looked like a hit on John F. Kennedy. They both had pistols and were disarmed by Secret Service, didn't get near enough to Ford, not well planned, thought out, etc. Thank goodness. But the first person, her name was Lynette Fromm. Squeaky Fromm was her nickname, and she was one of Charles Manson's followers, if you remember all this. And the second one, her name was Sarah Jane Moore. You ever notice how assassins always have middle names? Sarah Jane Moore, Lee Harvey Oswald, John Wilkes Booth. So do serial killers. John Wayne Gacy. Son of Sam. Son of Sam. Now that was David Berkowitz. Oh, what's his middle name? Anyway, it's an easy call. The reason they have middle names is we all have middle names, we just don't use them most of the time. But you aren't going to go out and say that Sarah Moore tried to kill Gerald Ford. Plenty of people are probably named Sarah Moore. You could use their middle name and it doesn't besmirch as many people. It leaves a lot of the Sarah Moores in the clear, as they should be. Okay, so let's go back a week. A week ago today, we knew we were in trouble, but we didn't know how much trouble. The question was, AIG was at risk, would they be okay, right? A week ago today on Monday, the Federal Reserve had bailed out. No, they let, well, let's see, they let Bear Stearns die, and they worked out an agreement by which I've already lost track of it. Which one was bought by Bank of America? It wasn't Goldman Sachs. It was, let's see. Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail, and they bought Merrill Lynch. Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch. That happened over the weekend. So Monday morning, there's a little bit of a panic, and John McCain comes out and says, the fundamentals of this economy are strong, as he has said many, many times over the course of the last year or so. That was Monday. Then, on Monday, in the stock market, the stocks fell. Was it 500, 450 points? What was the total points that the Dow fell? I don't remember the exact total, but it was 400 some points. Okay, and the question was, should they bail out AIG? AIG is an insurance company. We covered this last week. They have a lot of, they insure these risky mortgages and these risky financial instruments. So they could be in tune to the tune of hundreds of billions of bad loans. So the question was, should we bail out AIG? John McCain came out on Tuesday and said, first of all, he corrected himself within hours and said, I said the fundamentals were wrong, my mistake, they aren't that good. I'm not saying they're bad, but seriously, we've got serious, serious trouble here, and we need to deal with it. Tuesday, when they was talking of an AIG bailout, he said, I'm against it. By Wednesday, the government had bailed out AIG to the tune of $85 billion. They agreed. They took it over, essentially, and agreed to cover up to $85 billion in bad loans or bad claims. And John McCain reversed himself on Wednesday and said he was for it. So he's having a bad week because he reversed himself on whether or not the fundamentals were strong, and then he reversed himself on AIG. Okay. So Meanwhile, we get to Wednesday, and the U.S. basically, here's the headline in the Washington Post in big letters. U.S. seizes control of AIG with $85 billion emergency loan. Okay, so McCain's mostly a deregulator and is opposed to it in general. And this is why Democrats and the Obama campaign are claiming that you lay this at the feet of the Republicans. Now, there's blame for both sides, but the Democrats are going to win this argument. And the reason is that, so historically, Republicans prefer to deregulate, Democrats prefer to regulate. Republicans are always saying that there's too much regulation and that the Democrats are the party of big government. Well, it sounds good to be against big government until the system that doesn't have oversight jumps up and bites us in the butt and takes out hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayers' assets to take care of their problems. We had it in the 80s with the savings and loan bailout. That was predicted to cost up to $500 billion. In the end, I think it only cost us $125 billion. But that's a lot of money when you think about it. Okay, so McCain comes out and has done a couple of flip-flops. And so the Obama campaign starts attacking him. He starts attacking Obama. They both attack each other for their connections to lobbyists. And, of course, they both have them, although it's pretty clear McCain has more. And we'll get into that in a minute. And there's three people running this whole show. First of all, it's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, Hank to his friends. And so Hank has engineered this whole thing. He came from Goldman Sachs, the former. He had a previous relationship with Josh Bolton. Josh Bolton is the chief of staff for George Bush. And he came in 2005, I think it was, after the second term was started, and replaced. He was part of the replacement of the old Bush guard, and he was allowed to shake things up. So he went after Henry Paulson, who was chief executive of Goldman Sachs at the time, to be Treasury Secretary. And so he got him. So Paulson's in that job. Of course, he's right. If you run Goldman Sachs, you're pretty much tied in. You know how it works on Wall Street, and you know how investment banks work. The second person is Ben Bernanke. He's the chairman of the Fed, the Federal Reserve. And the third one, and you never hear much about this, is the president of the Fed, Timothy Geithner. But the three of them are kind of honchoing this whole relationship. Okay? So, McCain and Obama spent the week, particularly late in the week, trading shots and claiming that either your side was more to blame or you personally were more to blame, you didn't do enough to stop it, or you're tied to lobbyists. Well, they're both tied to lobbyists. Both parties are to blame. But let's face it, Obama's only been in the Senate 3 years. You know, Republicans have been hammering about the fact he doesn't have enough experience and he's only been in the Senate 3 years, and he spent a good part of that running for the presidency. It's a little hard to make the claim that he's totally consumed by the Washington environment then. Whereas McCain's been there 26 years and has roots going all the way back to the Keating Five scandal in the savings and loan time. Now, he's the maverick, and it is true Obama's taken a fair amount of money from Fannie Mae. I know all the stats. But let's not get bogged down with that. Let's do it this way. By Friday, it became clear the stock market was going haywire. It was up. It was down. It was not looking pretty. And the concern was that the whole system could collapse, meaning the global financial system could collapse. And so we ended up over the weekend getting a hint that the government would do something. The headline in Friday's Washington Post was, citing grave financial threats, officials ready massive rescue. So they were already previewing the fact that they were going to bail Wall Street out. The idea here was to send a signal to the world markets over the weekend, don't panic, there's no need for you to panic. And by Saturday, they'd set the thing in motion, and so the headline on the Washington Post was historic market bailout set in motion. And by the way, we're talking one-inch headlines on almost every day of the week last week. You don't get one-inch headlines unless there's some fairly dramatic news here. And that's what we got. So it comes out by Sunday that there is a three-page document, controlling document that's going here. And what the Bush administration wants to do is put one or two or three officials in charge of a $700 billion fund to bail out, to cover bad loans, to buy up bad loans from all these financial organizations so that the world is reassured that the financial system won't collapse. And get this, and this is what clued me in, and clued many people into the fact that this was not only unprecedented, this needed to be looked at a little more carefully. Section 8, under review. Keep in mind, this is only a three-page document. You know, we have, 80-page documents on how to pack cabbage, and yet we got a three-page document on how to deal with a financial meltdown that could affect the world. So Section 8 of this three-page document is titled Review. Quote, decisions by the Secretary, meaning Secretary of the Treasury, pursuant to the authority of this act, are non-reviewable and committed to agency discretion and may not be reviewed by any court of law or any administrative agency. In other words, we're going to invest the power in the Secretary of the Treasury to manage this $700 billion, and whatever he says is final. No one else can interfere or have a say. You can't take this to the courts. There's no other recourse. We're going to make him king of the financial world. Well, that's pretty breathtaking, really. And that caught people's attention. So suddenly, Republicans are out there and Democrats are out there complaining about it. Now, they may still pass something this week, and we'll discuss that when we come back. But you're listening to the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, and this situation is not pretty.